Welcome, everybody, to our podcast On the First Tee, where we look at a view of golf from behind the scenes. My name is Ian Butcher. I am the program lead at SRUC in golf course management, and my co-host.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Matthews, a lecturer in sustainable golf course management, an occasional weekend greenkeeper in St. Andrews, and as always, a forever hopeful golfer.
So why are we here, Ben? And what can the listeners expect? In our work at SRUC, we always talk about how we believe that golf is a force for good. We're passionate about the game of golf, and we're very lucky because we meet people all the time who are working in various roles behind the scenes. And they share with us and our students their expertise, they share their career journeys, but we've found that they're also sharing the love of what they're doing and where they're working. And we thought, why not share it?
And Ian, we have found that talking with this network of incredible people is always compelling. So it made perfect sense to invite these stakeholders of golf onto a podcast to discuss the issues that matter to them and the happiness that they've found in their careers within this industry. The podcast also gives us a great opportunity to highlight the outstanding careers that can be found within the game of golf, from the traditional to the new and emerging. We think all of these things are worth talking about, and we hope you do too. So please join Ian and myself on the First Tee for a view of golf from behind the scenes.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this issue of On the First Tee. And today we're very fortunate to be investigating behind the scenes at Kilmarnock Brassey. And we have David Addison, the general manager, and Kerr Rowan, the course manager, who are the management team, and they're going to describe their journey. So thanks so much for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. We're going to start with your personal journeys. How did you get into golf? Why did you fall in love with golf, and how have you come back to this great golf club?
My mum and dad were involved in golf. My mum and dad were the club master and club mistress at Royal Troon, basically when I was born. So played a lot of golf as a young guy, and played to, David will laugh, a reasonable level. Played to like 4 or 5 of a handicap, and was played at St Nicholas, played at Brassey. And the pro, Gregor Howie, who I'm sure we'll talk about later, had retired. He's just retired in the last year. But 20 years ago, when I was a youngster, he was basically saying, so what are you doing? Are you going to try and turn pro? Or are you going to do something else? You know, he knew I had a love of golf. But I grew up with like Gordon Sherry, Alan Reid, guys who were doing great things in the amateurs ranks. And I knew I was miles and miles and miles. I'm surprised David's not nodding his head here. Miles behind these guys.
Right.
So went into greenkeeping. There was a member at Brassey who was my teacher at Prestwick Academy, and he handed me a brochure for greenkeeping at Elmwood College. So in about 97 or 98, I went to Elmwood College as part of, there was 3 groups back then, Ian, I'm sure you remember.
I remember.
You were one of them. It was yourself, Mike Clark, and Len Stewart. Yep. So I was in the yellow group with Len Stewart, and he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, so passionate about it. And yeah, greenkeeping just went from there. And for me, it's been great. I've worked in Scotland, England, Sweden, America, Australia. And the job came up at Brassey, what, last August or something like that?
Yeah,
Guy, Brian Finlayson, has been here 30 years and was retiring. And I was quite happy where I was, but the chance to come home was just too much of a draw, and here I am, sat in the clubhouse at Brassey after being a junior here for 20 something years, junior into senior.
Fantastic. We might touch base on your experiences in Europe, but I want David to come in here, and can you tell us the same journey, David, just to set the scene?
Very similar to Kerr. I was I got into golf. My dad and my grandfather played golf. They were addicts, I suppose, is the best way to describe it. So my dad joined Brassey probably when I was about 5. Again, I joined the junior section at 9 or 10. And then you had role models within that. Kerr was one of the biggest hitters in the club, and we actually had a strong junior section to look up to. Lots of kind of scratch handicap golfers at that time.
Wow.
I was kind of fortunate myself to get down to scratch about when I was about 15. I had a bit of a golden year. I won the kind of Scottish boys under 16s. I played in the Scotland team at boys level. So that kind of continued until I was about 18. When I turned 18, I went to America. I got a golf scholarship in America with a view of trying to turn pro and make it. And quite quickly found out that I'm not good enough to turn pro and go on the tour when I went to college. So,
David, can I bug you and ask where was your scholarship at?
Yeah, it was at the University of Akron in Ohio.
Ohio, yep.
So, wow. Yeah, we played at Firestone every day, which was really nice. So, yeah, so it was good. We got to travel America, play tournaments. It was best 4.5 years of my life, if you know what I mean. So, when I was there, I didn't really know what to do. And the pro, Gregor Howie, who was my coach, and I came and worked in the summers for Gregor in the shop. He basically said, come and work for me, do your PGA professional kind of apprenticeship through him. So I worked for Gregor for, in total, for about 5-6 years, and did my training, qualified as a PGA professional, and then I went to Italy, worked at a club in Tuscany, which was great, and then came back to Scotland, worked at two clubs before Gregor then messaging me and saying, get your CV polished, there's a job coming up at Barassi for the general manager's role. And I honestly didn't think I would get it. I thought it was too young, to be honest with you, and managed to get through the interview process. So I've been here, this is my 6th year now as a general manager of the club.
It says something about your location there on the West Coast, if people don't know, the West Coast of Scotland, that you've come back from those wonderful locations. Huh? You weren't in bad places, were you? And you've come back to the beautiful West Coast.
I think that's it's strange. There's something, home will always be home, or it will be for me. You know, I kind of moved away when I was 20 years old. I'm now 45, and I've not spent an awful lot of time in Scotland. But there was something within me that knew it would always come back. And there's something about this club in particular. You know, there's a lot of junior members who've been juniors, went away and now come back, and there's something in the water here. I don't know. It's strange. I think you always realise this is home.
Yeah,
but it's so weird. Like when you try, I'm big on if somebody wants to go away for, you know, go and try and work in a different country, even if it's 2 months or something. You'll know where home is once you go and do that. I guess we've been fortunate because we've had the chance to be around Europe, America. You were in Australia and stuff, so
yeah, I think it makes you a little bit more I don't know, grounded or fortunate. Like people who I think have lived in Scotland their whole life, you know, oh, the weather's crap and Scotland's this and Scotland's that, but I think if you've been away you probably appreciate it a little bit more.
I would say so.
We're probably both in that kind of situation, and it's not like the west coast of Scotland isn't the worst place in the world to live. We're looking out the window right now and the sunshine and clear blue skies, and it's not really warm and it's not cold, so it's a nice place to be.
I mean, home will always draw you back. Home always draws you back. That's amazing. But you guys are both prime examples of where, no matter what you're doing in this industry, the opportunities they abound, don't they? I mean, the fact that you've been around the world, both of you, just by working in the industry, I don't think a lot of people know that are outside of the industry, and they just sort of see it as working on a golf course or working at a golf club. Can you tell us a little bit about the sort of the experience of going around the world? Obviously, you've spoken a little bit about that, but what about it would you tell other people that are thinking about getting into the industry and what it can do for them?
I think the best thing about this industry, it can open doors to the world for you. You know, being a pro, being a manager or a greenkeeper or working in food and beverage, you can go and do that in any country in the world that has golf clubs. So your transferable skills as well that come out of it. I think that's one of the huge assets that we've got within the industry, and maybe it's not advertised well enough, to be honest with you. You know, I've got mentors that I look up to that have left Britain and worked in America and Australia, so they've done it. So we, like, people who are looking to get into the industry can do it. So we had an apprentice greenkeeper before Kerr started. He came and he went and did the Ohio State program, and he's now in New Zealand, you know, and it's amazing what doors can open for you. So yeah, I think we're lucky. The one thing I probably can see from the industry is people are more willing to do it. You know, maybe in the past people had a job for life and the movement within the industry was very slow, whereas I would say now it's getting better with movement. You know, people are maybe doing jobs for 5 to 10 years and then they'll move, they'll progress up to the next job instead of staying in a position for 30, 40 years. Not to say that's wrong, but just that there maybe is a bit more movement. I don't know if you want to add.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, we were doing appraisals with one of my young guys the other day, and he was saying, you know, if I was to move around, what would you recommend? So I did the Ohio State project as well when I was 20, and I probably can't put it into words and justify it, but it was the best thing I ever did. It, maybe getting a bit deep here, it made me a man, you know, to go away from home. And I think the Americans are, the industry over there is maybe a little bit further forward than us. It's a bit faster paced. I mean, I was working 70, 80, 90 hours a week, and they were saying that wasn't enough. It was just, you know, it was, and I loved it. It was brilliant. I, for anyone to do the Ohio State project, I could not recommend it highly enough to any young gamekeeper. You're going to go over there. Michael O'Keefe will get you to, I'm sure, a brilliant golf course. I don't think anyone's ever been to a bad golf course over there, and it will be just a brilliant experience. I just couldn't say enough about it.
Yeah, thank you, Kurt. You're not the only guest speaker that said that, and we do have Mike O'Keefe coming on to the podcast. Let's talk about the journey then, because when you talked about how much you love your own landscape, you know, I was thinking that, you know, when I was looking at your, you know, the background of Kilmarnock Brassey and what is it that we offer, you know, you offer here in this beautiful country, and it is landscape, isn't it? And it is hospitality. Now, it seems that you've got a package there at Kilmarnock Brassey. And can you just talk about how you're going on a journey about governance? Let's start with the governance of Kilmarnock Brassey and how it's, if I'm right here, you're moving away from a committee led organization to a more professional team organization. Is that right?
I think that's your department. Yeah, I'm looking at you. That's your department, David.
So we are both lucky because the club was forward thinking before we even started here. The club in 2016, so they came away from a captain's committee makes all the decisions, and this is maybe being a bit blunt about it, but captain's committee made the decisions and the employees enacted those decisions, basically. And that didn't totally happen, but it's probably the best way to describe the change. Then to now, they set up a club council, which is really about strategy within the club and business aspects of the club. And then the captain's committee is more about just golfing and social aspects of the club. So where that's changed is we've been able, the club, then instead of having a club secretary, they made a general manager come in. And the council were then looking for the managers to advise them on what's best for the club operationally. So, like, club council meetings will be a chair, finance director, course development convener, and a facilities convener, myself and the captains. And we will talk about things that are happening in the next year, maybe 18 months, versus the price of scones, basically.
Yes.
So where we are lucky, probably as head of departments, is we get a huge amount of freedom to do what we want within our budgets. Because the feeling from the current council committee and even past ones since I've been here is you guys are the experts. You get on with it. That's what we employ you for. So, and there'll be times that they don't agree with what we put forward, and we've got to accept that. And there'll be times that they really get behind what we put forward. So they're there to represent the members. We're here to provide for the members, in a sense. So just due to the governance change, the club has become very efficient and economical in its business. So we've You know, we've been fortunate that they made this change before we came along. And to be honest with you, I don't think we would be here if they didn't change the governance back in 2016.
Yeah, that's some comment. Yeah, that's why you're here. Yeah. I think this is very interesting for other clubs, the journey you've been on. And we're going to Brough in a few weeks' time. We're going to have the same conversation with them. They're on a very similar journey. Could I just clarify, David, how many people sit on the club council again?
Three. So voting members, they have chair, finance, course development convener, facilities convener. And the two captains, the gents and ladies captain, get half a vote each. In all the meetings I've been at Brassey, there's never been a show of hands vote at a council meeting. Because everybody's getting a unit. There's been disagreements, you know, there's been differences of opinions, but they've all realised that there's been a general consensus and the best way to move the club forward.
Well, that must be probably due to the quality of the presentation being given by the heads of department.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm blowing you up there a little bit. But you do seem to be data-led. You know, we looked a little bit behind the scenes and we could see that, you know, seems to be over the last 10 years, your revenues have doubled from what I can gather.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to load this up so I don't make this up. So, yeah, in 10 years, our subscriptions, for example, have gone from almost 600K to it'll be 1.1 million this year and subs income alone. Green fees have gone from 100K to 340K. We'll probably do more than that again this year. So best way to describe it is the turnover, so your operational figure, it's up 800,000 in 5 years' time. And we actually don't have £800,000 worth more of staff to operate that. So we're busier than we've ever been. Basically, and we're going to be busier again this year. What the best way to describe it is we are bringing more money into the club for the money to reinvest back into the club. Whereas probably before the governance changed, it was how much money can we save from the club and please watch what you spend when you're in the club.
In sustainability, one of the frameworks is obviously ESG, environment, social governance. You've spoken quite clearly about the governance and the benefits that's had to efficiency, to your finances. Are you seeing benefits to those other two pillars because of this change in governance? Are you seeing benefits or improvements for the social side, you know, whether that's workforce, members, whatever? And has it had an impact on the environmental sort of considerations of the club?
I'll do workforce, if that makes sense. Let's take the Greens team, for example. We had the Greens team were on what I would describe as kind of very traditional contracts for golf clubs. You know, work your Monday to Friday through the week, and then it's overtime on Saturday, double time on a Sunday. And I personally didn't like it. I felt as though we were pressuring our staff to work at the weekends to chase money. So the club allowed us to go and see what other clubs were doing, what other setups were. We checked what other clubs were paying in the area, and actually we were paying like something like the second lowest for clubs equivalent to us. But the guys could top up their wage by overtime, and I was just like, that's not right. And I think the course would then kind of peak and trough a little bit with people, because Saturdays you would have maybe two people in, and some Saturdays you would have five people in. It was just optional overtime. So we changed our contracts so where the guys will do like Monday to Thursday, they'll do, what is it, kind of full time. But they work, so you work 36 hours 1 week and you work 44 hours the other week, and they're split into teams. So at the weekends, there's more consistent approach. We were able to look at the wage structures within that, and I would say probably now we've got that.
Yeah,
pretty much.
No,
good.
I think it's good.
So
I think we're trying to create as good a working environment as we possibly can. So I know David's going to take a lot of credit for this, but I've been here at Brassey just over a year, and on a Friday we finish at 10 o'clock in the morning. We do a half day on a Friday. So when I first moved up, I was like,
"Ian, are you hearing that?"
Yeah. it's wonderful. So I was a bit like, how on earth can we do this? This place must be run terrible. Imagine letting their staff away at 10 o'clock on a Friday. But it's really good because we're so busy on a Friday. If you're not out in front of golf, you're wasting your time. It's not you're here working, but you're not getting much out of your day. So to leave then, and for the guys who are working that weekend, they get a little bit of a break because they're then working the weekend. But for those who are not, they then get a 2.5 day weekend as well. So for us, I'm flabbergasted by it. It works really, really well. I think it creates a better atmosphere amongst the guys. But like one thing with this whole governance and the fact that now the club's run by the heads of the departments, that we're really trying to invest in staff. I think all four heads of departments realise how difficult it is to get staff, and if you find someone good, you've got to invest in them. I mean, I wouldn't say training's limitless, but in my time, no, you've never come back and said, nah, we can't afford it. You know, we do little things, birthday cakes on their birthday, a few meals here and there. It's small things, but I don't want to blow our own trumpet, but like when I sit down with the guys, everyone is really happy, and we have to keep doing this. It's the only way that we're going to have a good team and the golf course is going to continue to improve if we've got good staff who all want to be here.
It's the little things that make such a big difference, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. To take that kind of one step forward, it's kind of all through the club, you know, like changing the contracts, you know, it sounds easy, but there was some amount of stress getting it done because you have the guys need to buy into it, you know, and then, but we did it in other departments as well. We just knew, I guess we could see the other side how much it was beneficial, you know, and but we needed the guys to buy into it. Now, don't get me wrong, there was teething problems within that, and that's going to happen, but I can confidently say that the guys are reaping the rewards out of this decision that the club backed us to go down. So keeping guys like Kerr's probably been a bit modest, but we've not struggled to replace staff out in the greens side. You know, I'm not trying to be funny, but we put our job up, what, 5 jobs up in the last year or so, and we've had plenty of applicants for it. So that might dry up, but our goal is we need to make sure that that's still a sought-after position to be a greenkeeper at Barassi or work at the club in any other capacity. It needs to be, I really want to work there. So that's now our job to take that forward and become the place that everybody wants to work at. So but there seems, I don't know how we've done it, but there seems to be a real big kind of team atmosphere from the departments. You know, like food and beverage seem to, they know what's going on in the course, and, you know, the course guys obviously know what's going on within the clubhouse more so than ever. So, just in a nice place.
This podcast is actually, you know, wants to celebrate happiness, you know. So you've got two things going on there. You've got a happy team. Yeah. And that's opening up doors for people who are looking for somewhere to work. You know, why not work in a happy place? And I do think the happiness would probably stem from a feeling of productivity. Yeah. You know, you talk about that 10 o'clock, and I wonder how many golf clubs can look at whether they're just stuck in a, you know, these are the hours of work. But Kerr knows that you're not getting a lot done on a Friday after 10 o'clock. You know, your productivity is dropping right down, and what an incentive it is for young people to say, oh, this is great, I'm finished at 10. I can have another. Yeah. And this is very interesting. I think we've talked about this for the younger generation, you know, who have multiple things going on in their life, you know. Yep. they don't have one job and that's it, you know. They've got lots of things usually built around a phone, so giving them 18 hours a day to play on the phone is an incentive.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, money is not what they all look for, you know. It's time. So
yeah,
we've opened up that time element to them where they can go and be with their families, or they've got, like Kerr said, guys finish at 10 o'clock on a Friday morning, and you're not seeing them till, what, 5, 6 on Monday morning. That's almost a holiday for some people. So I guess giving them time to do things outside of work is huge.
Yeah. Can I just bring it back on the golf course revenue side? Can I just bring it back? A couple of questions I've got for you. The visitor income I read was 24% of total income. Visitor income is about a quarter.
of total green revenues. Something in that region.
Not so much anymore.
well, David, that's what I'm asking. Is that a figure you're happy with? Is that your target? Would you want it to be less or more? A good figure, basically. Is a quarter of your income, visitor income, for a members club, a good figure?
Right. Sorry, that is good. Yeah. I don't really want to become 50-50. I think that's too reliant on visitor income. I think as a club, if we can get to a quarter, then say a COVID happens and we don't see visitors, the club can still survive in the way we're operating at the moment. You kind of want to keep it in amongst that 25-30% in my mind. Some clubs will go 50-50. I get that. I get why they do it. But for us as a club, I think if we can keep it in that nutshell, sometimes we'll go to 40. I'm fine with that. And sometimes it might drop lower. But we are a members club, so the majority of the income should come from the membership. You know, the way I would like to see it in the future is if we can get the green fees just as pure bonus figure, basically. It's a very, very tough ask, put it like that, and it's a long, long way to get there. But if you could just have your visitor income as pure project income, like Carol have the best sheds in the world. Down the line, so yeah.
Well, that brings me on to that second question, really, is your costs, which have gone up, let's face it, for golf courses. I said 50% or 49% of your costs are on the golf course. So Kerr can ask this, but that would mean that you really do need somebody who knows what they're doing. If they're spending 50% of the budget.
You've put me in the spot now, Ian. Let's say that I tick that box. I mean, it definitely ticks that box. I'll put it like that. Yeah.
But it is important, isn't it, for clubs who are kind of not maybe appreciating how much their budget is being spent on the core asset.
Yeah. I mean, for me, David maybe has another answer, but people come to a golf course to play golf. They don't come to drink beer or to eat food. And we are very, very fortunate at Brassey that the catering's very good.
Very good.
You know, the bar scene, everything else is very good. But in my mind, people are coming to play golf. So that's, for me, I don't want to be like, oh, it's all my department, the money comes to me. But for me, the golf course is why we're here, why we have a members club. So if we can get the golf course as good as we possibly can, then, you know, hopefully our members see that, our members appreciate that, they bring more guests. It's, you know, social media is such a powerful thing now, so that, you know, if we're putting something on social media, hopefully it will bring in more visitors, more revenues. And, you know, we almost need to be on it every single day. If someone plays and puts something bad in social media, that's probably worse than putting something good in social media. So it is important. You know, one thing I will say about being at Brassey is I feel very fortunate that we've got sand below our feet. I've worked in a lot of golf courses at our Parkland or Heathland or whatever, and I just can't tell you the difference. I know it's a state of the obvious, but I can't tell you the difference it makes to have sand below your feet, to be able to play every single day of the year, to cut fairways, cut greens whenever you want. It makes a difference, and I think our members realise that and appreciate that as well. So we're every bit as busy in the winter as we are in the summer.
Kerr, we do teach that. It's just that nobody listens.
Okay, well, obviously something stuck in my brain 30-odd years ago, Ian, so thank you very much.
And since we're talking education, why don't we go ahead and take a break so we can hear from SRUC about their exhibit at the 2025 Royal Highland Show. We'll be back.
Heading to the Royal Highland Show this year? Don't miss your chance to discover the future of SRUC and have a bit of fun whilst you're at it. Come and visit us on 7th Avenue, right beside the main show ring. Whether you're curious about courses, careers, or just up for some interactive fun, then we've got something for everyone. Come and hook a Hilda or try your hand at the welding simulator. Have a swing at mini-golf with SRUC putts, or learn to save a life with some animal CPR. Visit local producers at our alumni farmers market Saturday, or explore our show garden for a burst of inspiration. You'll meet our brilliant teams from Vet Services, the School of Veterinary Medicine and SSE Consulting, plus chat to student ambassadors and our Students Association, who are potting your very own plant.
Whether you're into science, sustainability, animals or agriculture, or just want to know where your future can grow, come and find out more about our courses, research and student life. SRUC. Find your place, grow your future.
And we're back with David and Kerr, continuing a conversation with the operations of the business. We're going to get into a bit of food and beverage now.
Time rattles on. Can we move to F&B as a department? You're in-house now. You've moved away from franchising. Just wanted to share that. Not too much of a story, but the benefits of in-house over franchising. You're not looking back, I don't think.
No, it's fine. So we took it on, I think, 4, maybe 5 years now. But basically, there's no right answer to this. Like, I get why clubs go down one way and we went down another way and changed over, but it's control at the end of the day. We can, because it's in-house, we control everything now. We control the staff. We control the staff, then control the menu, the experience, the setup, everything. When it's franchise, if you're allowing that company to take that control, which again works in so many ways, so many different areas and clubs, we just felt it was better for our members for the club to control the experience of F&B. Basically, it costs us largely about £53,000 a year, but the members are more than happy with that. And I think for the club to only lose £53,000 a year, given what we put out in food and beverage, is really, really good. So we don't take a bar levy. We don't do anything like that. We just keep it quite simple, and simple seems to be working. So,
I've got to come on to that levy. Can I ask you about levies? Only because Ben and I are members of St. Andrew's Club, and we've just put it out to survey. You know, should there be a levy, and if so, how much? And I noticed that other clubs in your area do have levies. So you don't have a levy. The good and the bad of levies.
Is that a levy for F&B?
Yes, David. F&B only. Yeah.
I mean, we could levy. It wouldn't be a problem to levy, and you're largely just asking your members for more money at the end of the day, and we could levy £100 per member and cover that cost. And let's say we could bring in £60,000 through a levy. You're just giving us £60,000 more money to deal with it, you know, which is perfect. We can do it and run with it. But we just don't need it. We absorb it in our P&L, and our P&L will show that, like, we'll make a net profit of, let's say, £2,000 one year and £4,000 the other year. So it's not... And on the P&L, sorry, but it's not a thing we need to do, you know. And some members get, you know, some members do want a levy because some members want all the members to use it. So, which I get, but what, to be fair, one thing I'll always stick in my head, one of the guys that was on the council a couple of years ago said, if you put a levy in and it breaks even, there's nothing for the staff to chase financially. You know, okay. And I thought, do you know what? That's actually quite a fair point. You know, when it's losing money, their goal is to make it break even, and it always will be the goal. It's just going to be very tough. But he said, once you start making money, he said, you're giving them a chance for the standards to slip, if that makes sense. So he said, so it's sometimes better to not ask the members for more money, absorb it in your P&L, and the whole experience is better that way. So, if the club wants to do a levy, yeah, let's do it, you know, and we'll crack on. But yeah, for the club at this point in time, I don't think it's there.
Very good. That's very helpful, I think, for people to get that perspective. Kerr, can I ask you about the golf course? You know, the main challenges then, you know, for a golf course manager in Scotland these days, what do you think?
For me, it's probably two things. One is the weather and the other is staffing. So I've always kind of made a joke that managing the turf is the easy part. You know, the turf doesn't take sick days, doesn't come in late, doesn't ever have any issues. It's tough to get staff. And then when you've got staff, we kind of talked about it earlier, you need to look after them. you know, you did that presentation at Brassey a few weeks ago about the different generations and how people are on their phones so much now these days. And it's funny, we need to look after the young guys as much as the old guys, and we do have a bit of a younger team here, but trying to get a team, trying to get an ethos, trying to get guys to buy in, like I feel like I talk a lot to them, because we want to communicate, we want to keep them in the loop, and I think that goes a long way. There's nothing worse than a member stopping and going, why are we top dressing today? Oh, we're top dressing. Oh, I didn't know that. So you know, not knowledge is power type thing. So yeah. I think it is important that we have a good team, and if we do, then that just makes life so much easier. I mean, I could be the best golf course manager in the entire world, but if I can't get staff to work for me, I'm a dead goose. I'm in trouble.
How many are working for you? Go ahead, Ian. Sorry, Ben. How many are working for an 18-hole course?
No, we're 27. So
my apologies. So get out.
So we've got 12 guys here, which, you know, there won't be many course managers that actually say that's a good number or that's a decent number, but it is. The club have done a really great job in investing in the golf course. When I started, we hired our mechanic as well, or we promoted a guy to be a mechanic. We must have close to £1 million worth of machinery in the sheds, and we were waiting too long for things to be fixed and paying a premium. So we hired our mechanic, and that, for me, that's been brilliant. That has been a big win. It's been good for the guys as well. So yeah, that's good. On the part two of it is the weather. It's just not what it used to be. I'm an old man now, but
changed.
You know, it used to be, I know people talk about this in the industry, it used to be the moors went away in November. I remember working in Glasgow, and the moors went away to get sharpened in November, and you wouldn't see them again till March. So if you wanted to cut greens, you always kept a moor back. But traditionally it was colder, and there just wasn't as much grass to cut and stuff like that. But now it's, you know, it's 365, it doesn't stop. So yeah, the weather, I mean, we are now on the, looking at my watch here, the 25th of March, and we've had 8 mil of rain in March. You know, that's just crazy. That would never happen in years gone by. I think we had 30 odd in February. You know, the springs are getting colder and drier. April showers, don't know. I'm really hopeful we have some April showers, because the golf course at the moment needs some water. So for me, the weather's a challenge. You know, January we had 90 trees down, and whatever that storm was, and that's put a lot of work and a lot of time for us to clean that all up as well. So the weather plays a big part.
I think this comes, I just want to say this before Ben comes in, that I think it's so, you've already described, you know, the club culture, supporting, you know, you've got a professional management team around you that's supporting you. So when I was a head greenkeeper, I always found the weather the most stressful aspect, because it was out of your control. And to not have that control and to have problems, being confronted by those challenges and not have a supporting culture around you will drive you insane and will not end in a good story. So I think it's wonderful that the club, whatever happens, you lose 90 trees, but the club's going to be behind you as you try to solve that problem.
Yeah, I mean,
because it's a professional team. Yeah,
we get 90 trees down, and we got a contractor who came in from Ireland and cut them up and put them through a shredder in one day. He did 90 trees in one day, which is incredible. The biggest shredder you've ever seen, about the size of a double-decker bus. And that cost the club over £10,000. The club were like, we need to do it. We need to do it for the members. So it was, as you say, it was great to get that support. And then, you know, I'm looking out the window, as David said, it's a lovely day down here at Brassey, and we're still in some winter tees, and we're getting the odd grumble that, oh, why are we not back on the main tees? And I said to David, oh, we're getting the odd grumble. And he's saying, it was frosty last week. Just because the sun comes out for one day doesn't mean we're on main tees. So it's great for me to go in and get that support, rather than going, you know, it's the end of March. We should be on main tees. So, but I think we've all got each other's back. Let's say there's four heads of department, and we've got a WhatsApp group, and there's not much chat about work there. It's all about just slagging each other off and having a bit of banter and having each other's back. And just, you know, it's
As it's a bit, aye, like, to be fair, like, why would I tell Kerr to move the tees back at the end of the day? It's his golf course. He's the expert for turf health and playability. So, of course, I'm going to move him back when Kerr tells him we're going to move him back. But I'm going to support him if it's controversial, you know? So, yeah. We had a few moans and groans last week because Kerr and the guys were going temporary greens and then on to full greens at like 9:30 every morning. But, like, I'm not going to tell Kerr to put them on full greens when they shouldn't be on full greens. So, like, our job as managers there, we've got to support every department. And the biggest asset we've got in the golf course is our biggest spend, and it's the golf course. So we need to make sure we get it right, you know. And the last thing I'm going to do is come into Kerr and be like, you need to do this, you know, because it should be Kerr coming to me saying, we need to do this, you know. And so, we have a good bit of support in our team. And like, so the head of departments, a lot of banter between us. But we know if, let's say, James or Stuart said, look, I'm hearing quite a few moans and groans about this, they'll text us on the chat, and if it's legit, then we'll go and act on it. So things are getting done a lot quicker as well. Like, we are not the answer. We are not the 100% right guys all the time. We will make mistakes, but we should be allowed to make mistakes. You know, as long as they're not massive mistakes, then the club will keep improving, basically.
Barassi Golf Club. A rich, rich tournament history. Just looking at my list here, you know, final open qualifying, British Boys Championship, European Youth Championship, Women's Amateur Championship, qualifying series for the Open. I think an R&A Junior Open last year. What does that mean to you guys? And what are you hoping to see or attract in the future? And in that regard, are you both on the same page about it?
I think it's a great honour for the club to have these events, to work them at the time when you're in it and in the mix of them. They're really, really good fun. they're long hours, and at the end of it, you are knackered because you're just trying to make the best foot forward for the club and, let's say, the R&A or the whoever the tournament body is. But they're really, really good fun, and the spin-off from them for the club, you know, it kind of gives that level of, terrible to say this, but prestige, if that makes sense. So to say that we've held all these events shows that the club's capable of doing it, first of all, and the course is capable. So, yeah, like, I love them, to be honest with you, you know. Like, we had a big year last year because we had open qualifying, which... No disrespect to open qualifying, almost felt like a members medal, because the junior open and then the open week rolled in a month later, and it was you were in at the clubhouse at 5:30 in the morning and you weren't leaving until 10 o'clock at night. You know, my wife went on holiday that week, basically. So, but they're good fun. Like,
yeah. I mean, if you can't get motivated for the week of a tournament, then there's something wrong. But I mean, for me, we're both Brassy boys. So it's a lot of pride that the club is having these events. And, you know, we're in the Walker Cup lounge just now. And, you know, there is a great history of Brassy players playing at a good level and stuff like that. And it means a lot to me. I mean, if this club didn't mean so much to me, I wouldn't have came back. And probably the same to David. And, you know, as far as going forward goes, like, we've got, the club have got some ideas of some course changes, but I think a lot of the bunkering needs to change. You know, it's not, technology's moved on an awful lot, but I would like to be annoying some of our neighbours, like, you know, Royal Troon and Western. I would like the course to, we'll probably never be as good as them, but I'd like to prod them and poke them. And, you know, I would like to see this course get better and better and better. And at the moment, I don't see why it wouldn't. I think our attitudes have always been the same of, you know, we've probably never said this to one another, but we don't want to be the guys that screw it up for the club, basically, because we're so attached to it. So you get motivated in that sense. But I think because of our travels, you know, because I think America just pumps you up to think big all the time. And I think our experiences working at different level clubs and different experience clubs, I think we we see how big potential the golf club has, you know, on the and off the course.
Yeah.
So as Kerr said, yeah, like the bunkering needs done. And then I'll go back to him and say, yeah, but you need full course irrigation because you're mourning that it's not raining in the west coast of Scotland in April and May, or March, sorry. So we need to think wisely with the money we've got. But I just think there's so much potential. Like if as Kerr says, if we make some course changes and get the bunkering right in the golf course, that's our next step in the course's journey. That's a level up, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So we just need to flex our muscles a little bit and be brave and do these things. So I think Carol has proved to the members that, you know, little things that the guys have done over the last couple of years has can make positive change within the club as well. So
yeah, I like dream big, absolutely. I like that nudge of the neighbors though too. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, brilliant answer. We've talked about the golf course and we've talked about the food and beverage briefly. Can I move it on to the third revenue centre in the golf operations, the pro shop in a modern world, guys? I'm really interested in what you think about this. So in the last, let's just say, 10-year journey, you know, how has the pro shop developed in delivering a service to both members and to visitors?
So James, who's our head pro now, he just started on the 1st of January. So he took on from Gregor Howie, who probably been one of the biggest inspirations I've had in golf. Probably right. Same for Kerr.
Yeah.
Gregor, I'm biased with Gregor because I work for him and I love the guy. But Gregor actually had a brilliant experience for members and guests. You know, he just had this amazing knack of joking with members, making fun of members, yeah. And he had really high customer service. Not everybody's cup of tea, because if you go down that route, you will upset some people down the line, but the visitors he was excellent with. So,
it's that meet and greet you're talking about. He was really good at that.
Yeah. So in the office, we'll deal with a visitor inquiry. We'll get them set up in the tee sheet. We'll send them as much information about the club as possible that we think's relevant to that booking. But we'll always caveat with, when you arrive, go straight to the professional shop. They'll deal with the check-in. So that's the first point of call for any non-member, any visitor coming to the club. We guide them to the pro shop because we know that's the right place for them to check in for golf. And we know that they'll get looked after. So the meet and greet's huge. But the meet and greet's got to be huge, not just in the pro shop, it's got to be everywhere. Like the guys in the course that are working the course, they've technically got to be meeting and greeting as well. So they've got to say hello and how you doing, and maybe that's changed a little bit within the team, because maybe it wasn't a case of speak to people in the course. So pro shops it's always had that. To be fair, so James has more, when he took it on, it was more a case of continue that.
I think the reason Gregor was such a success here is he loved the place as well. He was proud of the place. I think if it was just a run-of-the-mill 9-to-5 job, the passion's not there.
Yeah.
And he was almost shown off every time someone came through the door, especially visitors. And I think James has got that as well. And if he does and he takes that forward, then, you know, the next 30 years is going to be similar to the last 30 years.
Yeah, and to be fair, Gregor was the club has this wee knack of bringing people back. Gregor was an assistant pro when he was a young boy to the pro Bill Lockie at the time. So Gregor went away, went to Germany and came back. You know, we've been away. We've kind of done a similar journey to him. James hasn't, but James was Gregor's assistant for, I think, 6 years. So he knows what's there. But James is young. He's got to go and explore that role himself as well. James has got that. James's big kind of selling point, his biggest asset, is he knows that the customer experience has to be right, or he doesn't have a business at the end of the day. So
that's why I'm asking. I think it's one of the areas that clubs are having difficulty with. I mean, is the pro shop offering something now that it wasn't before?
Coffee. we moved our coffee machine down there because the members were nicking the pods. You might have to edit that out. But that's
no, I'm sorry. No, I think you might be onto something.
The
The coffee machine is, as I always say, I'll have one mistake a year, and I keep getting reminded. The coffee machine is my mistake. I went to a golf manager's thing, saw a coffee machine, thought, that's the answer.
Yeah.
That is going to work for. We don't serve coffees before 10 o'clock. Got us signed up to this thing, and it never went at all. Never moved, nothing, and thought, this is a disaster. And then James said, I'm going to move that into the shop, and we'll come to a wee agreement here. Flying out the door. So by making a mistake, it's actually a huge success. So I think that's me got one free extra mistake to make this year. So, but sorry, what was the question, Ian? That was a silly answer.
No, Kurt, I don't think so. I don't think so. And you've touched on something. I mean, who's the biggest seller of coffee in the UK?
Coffee shops?
No. No, Shell. Shell garages.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, petrol. Okay,
so if you think about how much coffee shops are selling, Shell is beating that. So that's serious revenue. And you're offering something there which could generate serious revenue.
Yeah. So
anyway, anything else the pro shops are doing that they didn't do before?
Well, so ours was, to be fair, our, again, set up instead of franchise. So kind of like catering, we went the opposite way with catering. So Gregor was a retained pro. James is still a retained pro. We didn't bring James in-house. We thought about it. We didn't think it worked for the club to do it. We didn't think it worked for James or the new pro coming in, whoever that may be. So we thought it best for the club and the members of the club and visitors that we kept it as a retained. So we actually don't make any money out of the pro shop. That's their own business. But they think as though they're part of the team. They're very much part of the team. All three, Fraser, who starts in a couple of weeks' time as a new assistant pro, they are very much in every decision-making process that the four of us go through, basically. So, and I would say that's part of every team. You know, like the food and beverage, Stuart's team, yeah. Food and beverage will be part of every decision-making process. So,
David, yeah. you're coming on to really what my last question is, because I think in our curriculum we're really emphasizing the importance of communication, and I think you're going to answer this. I expect the answer already. Is there good communication between the teams? And obviously, so I'm up in the Highlands 2 weeks ago in a gathering, you know, of head greenkeepers, and it was really alarming how many hands went up when we asked, you know, how many are having communication problems within their club structures, you know, and pretty much the majority of the room are having communication problems. And three hands went up and said, it's broken down completely. There is no communication. So that's how bad it can get. So it's great to talk to somebody that maybe is going to say, no, our teams talk to each other. Is that true?
Yes, definitely. Well, I think so. I mean, every day the four of us will talk. You know, it might not be we don't have weekly meetings or anything
Do you not? I was going to ask about the frequency.
We don't need them, to be honest with you. Like, Kerr will be in the clubhouse daily. James will be in the clubhouse daily. I actually think when we see that van coming in, everybody comes into the office, basically. It's community almost. You know, we're not really there with community, but it's looking out for one another. That's the main thing.
Just wrapping it up, I mean, again, you lead on so well there, David. It does strike us as a community. And the other thing that Ben and I picked up in some of your material, which really struck us, and we're going to talk about it more afterwards, but there were 30 families that the golf club supports, you know, in terms of employment. That really struck home with us because you know, talk a little bit about that. You know, there's a family community there all working together, but then going outside of the club and, you know, being part of a wider community.
Like, this is our passion, I suppose. We're here because we are, like, weirdly, I'm super passionate about golf management and golf clubs. Like, Carol, super passionate about course management, golf clubs. But some people, this is just a job. You know, this is just a way to get money to pay their mortgage, a way to get money to put their kids to university, you know. So we have to recognise that it's not maybe their passion, but they do a 10 out of 10 job for us, you know. So then there'll be people who are incredibly passionate about different levels of the golf club setup, and we need to, either drive that forward for them, or we need to just service that. If they can work what we need them to work at the golf club, we need to make it that they're looked after their families at home. So the biggest thing is, you're right, it's 30 families now. Not everybody here has a family, okay? And everybody's family is different, and everybody's home life is different. But the last thing I want is somebody walking through this door dreading coming to their work, you know? And we had that. I'm not trying to say this has always been rosy. We've had that within different aspects of the golf club. But I don't want anybody sitting on a Sunday night going, I really can't do this tomorrow, can't go back to work, you know? And again, we have had that, and I'm touch wood, I think we're past all that now. But that's obviously because the club have bought into the changes that we've tried to make this a community. So when the family, because when that presentation came up, I actually talked to the captain about it. I said, what do you think about this? Because the current captain, when we wrote that slide, he's been part of the club in a sense since the pre-changes to now. And he was like, you've got to put that in, because that's the way I view it. That's the whole place is a family. The club's a family. We don't all disagree. Families fall out at the end of the day. But, you know, if family's a word, then we've got to keep running with it. So, yeah, that's why that's in there. And, you know, everything you do, it's a big thing for a family. You know, like Scale said, pay rises have gone in. The club support the pay rises. We go for it, and everyone gets the same, you know. You want somebody to go up the road to their partner at home and say, you know what, I just got a pay rise this year, you know, and they go, geez, oh, like, I thought the golf club was a terrible place to work, you know. So, you know, so things like that.
That's why we picked on you, David. That's why we picked on you, Kerr, because we could tell that you had a story to share with others, that it can be done. It can be done, this journey, you know, and it is led by governance, isn't it? It's the governance that's put all this in place. But there is a way of making this work, and it to be a happy place of work.
We got lucky, I suppose, and I suppose we've been lucky with the people we've dealt with at the moment. Up until now, like, not trying to be funny, we could have had completely different personalities in our interview boards, and Kerr could have walked up the road going, I'm not going there. No way, if I've got to do with those guys, you must be joking. Well, so
after the guy fell asleep in my interview process, I did think long and hard about it, but I overcame that.
Wasn't me.
Guys, I just wanted to thank you so much for your time today, but just sharing these really encouraging perspectives. I don't think we hear enough just in general in any industry about people not just loving their jobs, but loving where they work. And that's obviously filtering out to the rest of the team. From you guys. So thank you so much for that. I just think it's really inspiring, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Kerr. Well, Ben, that was a great podcast with Kerr and David at Kilmarnock Brassey, wasn't it? I was so cheered up, you know, really by their observations, by their passion, by their enthusiasm, by their journey, which I know is going to have real relevance for other clubs listening into this. I've already been speaking to people about this journey that they've taken. From, dare I say it, amateur committee to professional management.
Ian, how lucky are we to, you know, not only be working within this industry ourselves, but to be able to talk to these guys and hopefully gals in the future that are just so passionate about this industry, that just so passionate about their jobs. It is, I said it during the podcast, but it is truly inspiring. And I mean, if I was ever having a down day thinking about work I had to do, all I have to do is listen to these guys talk about how lucky we are to be in the industry and what the alternatives are, you know. So again, two guys not only passionate about their jobs, but absolutely in love with the golf club that they work at.
Yeah. So a couple of takeaways I had. I mean, one, it was the communications between the teams. Because as we've traveled, you know, around, we are hearing that this is apparently still a problem in the modern world, that, you know, different departments aren't necessarily regularly talking to each other or have a high quality communication. And, you know, Kerr and David were talking about it almost on an informal basis. It's not planned. Under James up at Cable Links in the Highlands was talking about a regular weekly meeting, which was, because it's so frequent, nobody's talking for a great length of time. You haven't got to really get ready for it so much. You're being asked to say something about what's going on in the golf operation that particular week. But it's not like you're preparing a 6-month forecast, or it's just it's the frequency that means the dialogue is there. And you know, David and Kerr were saying, well, it's almost happening, you know, organically. You know, we're not making a plan, but we're almost communicating on a daily basis, not a week.
It's an ongoing conversation, isn't it? Yeah, it's an ongoing conversation. It's not a formal presentation, so there's no pressure around it. It's just this informal chat about the operation of the business, and what a way to do it. You know, everybody seems to be jumping on board with that.
I think it contributes to the happiness you talk about, but it also, why is it important? It means ultimately you're delivering a higher quality product to visitors, and that leads to more revenue. So this is really, really important, you know, and I just wonder how many golf clubs in the UK are actually, you know, have really nailed this.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, whatever they're doing it right. You look at the numbers there in revenue, and, you know, it's just jumping and jumping. And I mean, if I was a member of that club, I'd be more than happy to see those numbers.
That's right. That's right. You're in good hands. And I think that was what their journey was about. You're in good hands. And final comment for me, final takeaway for me was that bullet point that we saw from them in preparation for the podcast was the 30 families in the community that are directly supported by that golf club, directly supported. And Ben, I was thinking, how many other rural businesses can claim that direct, you know, financial support and contribution to that community of Kilmarnock? I can't think of any other business that would actually have that many families directly support.
These guys are clearly connecting what they're doing, the employment opportunities that are there, and how that is supporting their community. And you can tell, again, I'll go back to it. This is my final point. The love for the club that David and Kerr obviously have, and that resonates throughout the whole business operations. You know, they're not just talking about their job. They're talking about the 30 employees. They're talking about, they want their employees coming in, you know, everybody has an off day, but they don't want anybody coming in dreading their job, you know, thinking, ah, another slog shift, you know, have to get through this here at Kilmarnock. No, everybody's coming in and saying, hey, I'm happy to be here. Whatever level of involvement I have, I'm coming in and I'm happy to be here and I'll do my best. That's, you know, you're getting this amazing output from your employees in that situation. I'll do my best. And then they go away happy.
Fantastic. It was a delight, wasn't it? And if anybody's listening, do check out their website, Kilmarnock Brassey, which we'll send a link to in the podcast. And thanks very much for co-hosting, Ben. And we'll see you all next week on the first tee.